The Honey Net Project.
You think we got everybody coming in?
Where we get somebody to see?
All right. We'll go ahead and kick this off. You are in the room for the HoneyNet presentation. If you're thinking for something else, then you are in the wrong room. My name is Lance Bitzner, and these are members of the HoneyNet Project, and we're here to pontificate about all sorts of wonderful and exciting things. We have two sessions. This is the plan of attack. The first session, the one you're sitting in right now, is we'll cover what the HoneyNet Project is, things we've done, how we did it, and what we do with the findings, kind of everything that's happened in the past 2 years. You'll take a break, and then you come back for the second session. Second session is everything we've got coming up. A lot of new and exciting things. We have quite a few big announcements and new technologies we're introducing and things like that. This presentation is going to be a little different than the presentations you've been attending. We do have a set of slides. Slides have been modified since they've been burned to the CD-ROM, so they're a little different than what you have. But what really makes it unique is this is the largest grouping we've ever had of the whole project. There's probably about 20 members from the HoneyNet Project here, which really makes it unique. So instead of us sitting up here and pontificating and going along these wonderful slides, the idea is to make this interactive, the chance for you folks to ask all these different members questions about what we've done and things like that. Yeah. So what we're going to do here is we've got a presentation. We're going to kick it off. We're going to start it, start telling you some wonderful things. And at any point you want to ask anybody a question, just go ahead, raise your hand, and ask one of any members.
Where are your shoes?
Go ahead. Oh, he's taking pictures too. Great. Oh, you get his feet. Yeah. He got a little drunk and notice his lovely toes, shade of pink. Yeah. Anyways, before we start, like I said, what's really going to make this unique is many members of the HoneyNet Project are here. So how about we go ahead, starting from one end and working down, we'll get just introduce the members so you know who's where and what they do. So guys, just who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm Ophir Arkin. For the guys that were here before, I do the ICMP stuff. I do active operating system fingerprinting, passive operating system fingerprinting, other stuff, and I'm from Israel.
I am Saumil Shah, working with Foundstone. I'm an R&D and a consultant over there. Mainly work with web hacking these days. In the past, Black Hats, you might have seen the talk. Work closely with Lance on the HoneyNet Project as well.
I'm Jay Beal. I work on Bastille Linux for Mandrakesoft, which means I do a lot in securing systems.
I'm Ed Skodas with Predictive Systems, a security consultant. Work on network architecture.
I'm Lance Spitzner, security architect for Sun Microsystems.
Dave Dietrich, senior security engineer at the University of Washington. I dabble in reverse engineering DDoS tools and Unix forensics.
Marty Resch, I'm the founder of SourceFire. I do snort, packet wrangling, all things involving packets and packet forensics.
Frank Hyde, I'm a managing security architect for At Stake. Mostly do security consulting.
I'm Jop de Haas. I'm from Amsterdam, Holland. I have a pen test company, and I enjoy, among other things, kernel hacking.
I'm K2 from Vancouver. Periodically, ethically compromise the HoneyNet to spice up Lance's life.
Oh, good one, too.
Hi, I'm Dr. Max Kilger, and I'm the team social psychologist.
We're friends.
I'm John McDonald. I work for PGP, and I find bugs.
I'm Jeff Stutzman. I'm with Cisco up in Boston.
Yeah, what he didn't mention was he used to be a naval intel weenie. And then you're sitting off the side, but you better talk about yourself.
I'm Rob McMillan. I'm a Marine Corps officer currently studying at the Naval Postgraduate School, and I'm just tagging along.
Oops, sorry. Okay, the idea here is I want to do as little talking as possible. We're going to try it. You guys just jump in whenever you want and stuff like that. We're going to go ahead and kick things off. One thing you probably notice is there's a very big mix here, and there's actually quite a few members that aren't here. They'll probably be here in the second section. We've got people from Israel, Canada,
Where? Holland. You can call that a country. It's more like a state. Yeah, I know. Five new exploits released for Solaris. But let's go ahead and kick things off. Okay, like you said, this is what makes this unique is this is the largest gathering of the HoneyNet project. Probably be more of us here this afternoon. This is not a monologue. We're not here to pontificate about all sorts of wonderful things. As you're going to see, our goal is to help the security community, so feel free to beat up, ask all sorts of questions. What? Too fast?
No. All good. It's all good.
Okay, what is the purpose of this session? To explain what the HoneyNet project is, how we work, what we're all about, and what we have found. What our research is based on is intelligence, gathering intelligence on the enemy, the Black Hat community. Here's two cute little quotes here on, my throat is going, on, you picked out the first one.
Classical education.
Yeah, there we go. Anyways, what these guys are saying is knowing the bad guys is critical. It's something we've been doing for centuries in the military. Just my background, I spent 7 years in the military, 4 years as a tank officer in the Rapid Deployment Force. So I have quite a bit of military experience myself, as so do quite a few members here. And the big thing we've learned is gathering intelligence on the enemy is critical. As Bruce Schneier was saying earlier, everything in security has been prevention, detection, and reaction. Well, we're about taking the initiative and gaining intelligence on the bad guys before they attack. And there's quite a few and exciting things you can do with that. If you guys want to jump in, feel free. Here is... Here is our plan of attack for today. Introduction, which we're covering now. The HoneyNet Project, basically what we've done, who we are, what we're all about. I'm just curious, how many of you have heard of the HoneyNet Project before you came here? Whoa. Either we're doing something right or we're funny. Then we're going to talk about the enemy, what we've learned about the bad guys, how we learned it, and then we're going to give you some real-world examples. And then we'll wrap things up. And then, like I said, the afternoon session is everything we've got coming up. Things coming in the future. Introduction, as we said, security has traditionally been focused on prevention, detection, and reaction, as Bruce mentioned earlier. Everything is defensive. The bad guys have the initiative. What we're trying to do is attempting to change this. We want to take the initiative and gain intelligence on the bad guys and encounter them before they even move. And we're going to show you examples of how we can do this and how we've done this. All right. We are a group of 30 security professionals. That's what we tell the media. Actually, we're a bunch of 30 security curious geeks, if you want to put into that. We're all really interested in learning and researching and sharing that information, and that's what we're all about, as you see everybody here. We began about 2 years ago, 1999. It was an informal war games list, and it's been growing over the past 2 years. We officially called ourselves the HoneyNet Project, for lack of any better name, on June 2000. So we've been official, a real group, for over a year now. What's that?
No. We should have let Marty pick the name.
Yeah, he's got a better name.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, I'm kind of going this first part fast just to give you a little feel so then we can go ahead and get in the fun technical guru, all the geek stuff, and then everybody can get involved. The goal of the project, our mission has always been and always will be to learn the tools, tactics, and motives of the Black Hat community and share those lessons learned. We're not about us just sharing, learning all this information and then just sharing amongst ourselves. We try to share everything we know and learn with the security community. And it says at the bottom, we take the initiative by gathering intelligence on the enemy, the bad guy, the Black Hat. There was value, two areas of value in this. One is awareness. One of the things you see is we show how the bad guys hack systems step by step, how often they hack systems, why they hack systems, how they do it, their tools, their tactics. This raises awareness. A lot of people don't realize they're at risk, that they can be attacked. We want to show them that, yes, you can be attacked. Yes, you will be attacked. For those of you who are aware, and actually that's the majority of the people in this room, the reason you're here, you're aware, is we want to give you more information on how the bad guys operate, the tools, the tactics, why they attack your system, so you can better defend your systems and networks. Awareness. We've been developing awareness within the security community by series of papers. These are areas of papers where we release our research. These papers are written by the whole project. They're not written by a single person. Certain members have certain specific specialties. they will develop certain papers in those areas and specialties.
Give some examples of the papers.
All right, go ahead.
Well, we've got Worms at War, which is a paper that describes how some worms went after a Windows box. We've got Motives, which explores some of the reasons that various systems were hacked. There's a paper that talks about the architecture of HoneyNets, a whole bunch of things. So what are there, 9 papers now?
Yeah, 9, 10 papers, something
nine
like that.
9 or 10 papers.
Now, some of the... go ahead, man, if you want to talk, jump in.
I'd like to use this one. Now.
Okay, might as well.
It's easier to hold.
Ooh, there we go. Got to hold it closer, though. All right, now more exciting is not only are we developing awareness, but we're developing information on how they do things. For example, one of the exciting things we did was the forensic challenge.
Whoops, where's Dave? Oh, there
you Okay, segue. The forensic challenge was us taking a Unix system that was hacked in the wild, Linux in this case, taking the bitmap images of the partitions on that system, making them available to the community, and letting everybody do their best shot at trying to figure out what happened to the system and producing a good report, keeping track of time, all of those kinds of things. I did the same thing as an example of the kinds of stuff that I do. I think we had, 18 submissions, something like that? The largest one being a team of 3 people spending over 100 hours.
That's it?
Any questions?
Yeah, we got questions. What was neat about the forensics challenge, it was the first time it was ever done. The FBI and Department of Justice was excited because now they had information they could talk about because that's something they normally can't release to the community. Did anybody here take a look at the forensics challenge or attempt to? Okay, quite a few. Rumor has it, if Dave ever gets time again, we might actually try another one. How much of their time did that take? Of your time?
My time?
Yeah.
Over that month, I probably spent over 100 hours, and that was both doing an analysis. I counted 30 hours for the analysis, although I was doing some other stuff as well, plus trying to get the judges, get the standards all set up. It was a lot of work, but it was pretty fun.
You have 70 already boxes at UW we could use for the next one, right?
One thing, too, is with the project, we have absolutely no income, none. And everybody does this on their own time and volunteers. So, I mean, we all know how busy we are in security community. So if he's blowing 100 hours on this, it shows you he's a hardcore geek. Other things we've been doing to raise awareness is Scan of the Month. This is a challenge where people try to decode. Every month we go ahead and say, hey, this is how a real system was hacked. All our systems are real. It's real black hats that hack our systems. We have nothing to hide. And we'll go ahead and we'll post information on scans of the month. Anybody want to talk about a scan of the month? For example, this scan of the month, what we did is we posted the IDS alerts and the firewall logs for an entire month of the bad guys hammering our HoneyNet. And the challenge to the community now is to go ahead and determine what the black hat activity is, trends, analysis, things like that. See, the problem is many of you in the security community can't release this information. If one of your computers got hacked, the last thing your boss wants you to do is image that hard drive and post it to the world to see how we got hacked, why we got hacked. That we have that advantage. So we posted the scans, we posted all sorts of stuff. Last month's was interesting because somebody's certain computer, you want to talk about that?
Last month's scan was interesting in that the last month's scan was particularly interesting because it was some rudimentary encryption on the file that was utilized in the kit, the root kit. And one of our members said, gee, that looks remarkably familiar.
just a little background on that one. The last month's scan of the month was, here's a root kit. We found it in the wild. One of the files was encrypted. You need to go ahead and decrypt it, you know, to challenge your encryption skills. So if you want to do it, go ahead, check it out, last month's scan of the month. We're all at CanSec West, an awesome, well, can we promote other conferences? Okay, we were at a CanSec security conference a couple months ago, and one of the members on the team noticed one of their computers was hacked, and us being all sorts of geeks decided to look at the rootkit and decode the rootkit. And
I'll let you tell the story. Marty, you were part of that, weren't you?
Basically, this file's on the system. It looks like it's part of a rootkit. don't know exactly what it is. It looked kind of familiar. A few of us were poking around. I did my bit arithmetic incorrect at first, so it kind of got sidetracked. Decided that it was an interesting challenge. The person that actually who won? Was it the one that you showed me? Pretty elaborate description of his techniques for going through and trying to do the decryption step by step. Rather interesting. While we're sitting here looking at this thing, I had seen this before, and I said, URK, Universal Rekit, anybody, you guys familiar with this thing? And Lance goes, oh, shit, K2 wrote it. They're like, dude.
So our own members are writing code that are getting in our boxes.
Yeah. Question, go ahead. Last month, did we see the leaves worm? The question is, last month, did we see the leaves worm come through the honey net? Right now, the plug has been pulled on the honey net. So no, we did not, because our honey net's not up. Why is our honey net not up? Two reasons. One, for the past 2 years, the honey net has been 4, 5, 6 boxes sitting in my spare bedroom. In fact, I had a party at my place a couple months ago, and these guys came over, and they look at it, and they're like, that's it? And the problem we ran into is it's just a little ISDN line sitting off my spare bedroom at home, and I can't change IPs all the time. All the black hats, all the good black hats know my IP addresses. I mean, you've caught IRC sessions where people are talking about it and stuff like that. So all we're getting is the script kiddies, and which is good information, but after the 10th time to hack it and they use the same tools, same IRC channels and all that stuff, the information is worthless. So we pulled the plug on it because we're really not learning anything else. Now we're going to start doing fun and exciting things with through honey nets, i.e. we're getting out of my spare bedroom, my wife gets off my case, and we start doing some new and exciting things. And that's what we'll be talking about in the next session. Long answer to your short question, no, we didn't get it because the plug is pulled right now in the honey net. And then once again, the Know Your Enemy series of papers, we release everything. We release source code, all sorts of good stuff. And the papers will show you just how the bad guys hack a Solaris box, how they hack a Linux box. And what's fun and exciting is, like I about 5, 6 months ago, one of our Linux boxes was hacked by what's called the NameD NXT exploit, something Horizon's a little familiar with because he wrote it. So the nice thing is that's why we have so many people in the team, is to go with the expertise. If I have a problem with ICMP, I don't look at it. Ophir, help with the ICMP. Somebody's talking in Urdu, Samuel, just go ahead and do the translation. There's quite a breadth of expertise on here. And actually, people ask me, well, working in the HoneyNet project, you really must be sharpening your skills. My technical skills have gone to the toilet. I mean, think about it, oh, gee, forensics. Dave, help! Or, no, I'm having problems with snort. Marty, help! But there's an incredible breadth of different skill sets here. And that's one of the things we found. These systems would be hacked, and we needed help from different people. And everybody here represents a different kind of skill set. Like I said, if you got questions, shoot, as we're going along here. You got a lineup of geeks. For the forensics challenge here, there's the URL at the bottom. All the analysis has been released. If you want to download the images and practice your own forensic analysis, go ahead. Question. All right. I want to remain employed, so we'll...
We do model the insider threat. That's why we have K2.
On the insider threat, too, one of the problems that the HoneyNet project struggled with at the beginning is we release information, and we would get attacked for it because people really didn't trust us. An example of this lack of trust. One time, we identified black hats that had compromised hundreds of systems. We thought we'd be the good guys, and we contacted the admins of those hundreds of systems. I got more emails with lawyers threatening to sue us because they're explaining, HoneyNet project, you guys must have hacked us, and things like that. So nobody would really trust us. Now that people actually semi-trust us, organizations are beginning to put HoneyNets in their internal networks. That's why we introduced you to that Marine guy earlier. Navy's starting to put them up. Universities are starting to put them up, things like that. And that's something we'll get into the next session, the second session, about where we're going and stuff like that. But now that we've proven it actually works, people are starting to get interested in it, and we're starting to look at both the insider and the outsider threat. You guys want to jump in?
All right, the monthly, the scan of the months, like we said earlier, for the month of July, we got all sorts of attacks and scans coming on. Our HoneyNet's just pounded. It's actually from the month of November, so you can look at that raw data. Gives you a chance to go ahead and munge that data, see if you can predict attacks. And then what you can do is once you don't even have to submit anything, but go ahead and try it out. Because at the end of the month, we post everybody's results. How many people have you ever submitted for the scan of the month? Okay, one, two, three. Yeah, there's a new one each month. Yeah, and every time it's something totally different. So you make something, just all you can do is learn, and then we'll post who we think the top result, who the top entries were. You can learn from them, and then we, the project, try to post the answers ourselves. And then the Know Your Enemy series of papers, once again, there's the URL at the bottom. Okay, now I'm going to start jumping in a little more technical and stuff like that, and guys, jump in. Honeypot concept of honeypot is nothing new. It's been around for quite a few years. Introduced by guys named like Cliff Stoll, Steve Belevin, some of the other guys with Burford. The idea being honeypots are not a new concept. The idea behind a honeypot is normally a system's built with the intent that to be compromised. But traditionally, it's been emulated. They emulate processes, services, deception toolkit is an example. CyberCop Sting is another example. You just build a box and emulates a bunch of things. Here are some examples. We got deception toolkit, Spectre, Mantrap. If you want to look at them, go ahead and try them out. Wonderful. They have great potential in doing specific things. However, it's something that we, the project, is not looking for. A HoneyNet's a little different. A HoneyNet, the two big differences are, one, it's an entire network. It's a real network. It's multiple systems. We don't emulate five systems. We put five systems in there. It can be anything you want. It can be an LTN switch, Linux Red Hat server, web server, Solaris box, Cisco router, anything you want. Two, nothing is emulated. They're the real systems. What we do is we put these HoneyNets out there. It's a network of production systems. We just sit and watch them. Take a couple boxes, put them on the internet. Same kind of boxes that are sitting in your organization. If you do a default install of Solaris, we have default installs of Solaris, things like that. So what we learn applies to your organization. As we stay here, nothing is emulated. Nothing is made more insecure. We don't have to worry about that. We don't have to do it. The systems tend to come bad as is. So we don't go at, oh, let's go ahead and start all these services so that makes the system more insecure. In fact, sometimes we'll go ahead and we'll make systems more secure. And that's the direction we're going. We'll cover that later. What's the value of this? Since nothing is emulated, everything's production, the bad guys have real systems, so whatever we learn with our systems applies to your networks. The bad guys can get on there, get a command prompt. Question? The question is, do we default install or do we tighten them down? Both. Sometimes we do a default install. Sometimes we do default install and then tighten the system.
So I'm a new member, I guess. So one of the things I want to see if we can explore is actually see what happens if we try to perform all best practices and still and give somebody something to go for, are people still getting through? And I think that'll be really interesting to see.
Just for the tightening down part of it, is if you want to avoid stuff you just don't want to see, uninteresting things, because if a box gets completely owned, there's going to be a rebuild involved. So if you know RPC StatD stuff, you're not going to keep that out there. I mean, we know what that looks like. We know what it's about. So you just shut that off so you don't have to get redundant data.
Question, go ahead. The question was, like, what about VMware? The advantage being you have real operating systems running on virtually.
What's that?
Things like that. We have people that are researching that. That's something we're looking into. But one of the things we like about just using standalone systems is something like Dave's forensics challenge. If we do a forensics on a VMware box that's emulating a bunch of systems,
secondly, right now we get VMware only with the x86 architecture. With MIPS, Spark, we don't have any choice.
Right.
One of the things, we don't want to scare people away really quickly. I mean, a semi-sophisticated attacker is going to look at the ARP cache when they get on the box. And the thing is there, even if you're in the emulated environment, you're going to see that those weird ARP entries, and you're going to, that ARP bridge, the VMware ARP bridge, and you're going to know you're on a VMware and emulated box.
But by that point, they're already on the box.
Well, okay, the question is the point is they're already on the box. Go ahead.
I have done quite a bit of work with honeypots over the years. Back when Snort was written, because I was working on a honeypot. So basically, there's two kinds of honeypots in the world. There's production honeypots and research honeypots.
Oh, man.
That's one loud phone.
It's a guy in a pink sweatshirt.
So anyway, there's two kinds of honeypots in the world. In a production honeypot, all you want to do is get the notification. You just want to know, you want to gauge his intent, you want to see what technique he's using to get to you in the first place, then you want to just block him out and get rid of him. With a research honeypot, you want them to linger. You want them to stick around so the guys in the lab coats can sit there and figure out, ooh, this is fascinating. We have a new bit twiddle here. Outstanding.
Don't forget, one of the things about the HoneyNet project, too, is we don't care how they got on. What do they do once they get on, too? We've had bad guys in our systems for more than 3 weeks. So we want them to sit there. We want to watch their conversations, their keystrokes, all sorts of activity. That's where the fun happens. We got examples of that later.
Exactly correct. The true fun happens with IRC logs.
And we're going to have our IRC decode expert, Samuel Shaw, go into this later. We see how some guys decided to take out his country. So not only was he decoding it, but he was like getting into it first. Yeah. Well, we'll do it for questions. Yeah, we'll start here and just keep going our work away for questions. Question. Have we ever tried to actively fingerprint? No. The HoneyNet project does nothing active. Nothing. Why do we think we have people like Ophir on our network?
We do nothing active.
Even though we don't fingerprint them, we're actually working on, we have some functionality for Snort that will let us do passive fingerprinting of the systems probably in the next couple of months.
Very short and sweet, active, you know, therein lies litigation.
Also, on the active, the trick to a good honeypot, a good honey net, from a research perspective, remember, we're all here about research. We're not developing a product for you to drop in your network unless you're interested in research. Real quick, on research, the thing is the bad guys must never know they're on a honey net. They must never know they're on a honeypot. If you start going active, they scan you, you scan them, they might know something's up. So everything we do, and we'll go into that later on, we passively capture everything so they never know they're on a system, unless we intend, we actively let them know. Question?
To preserve the illusion, do you do things like run Bogus web servers on the boxes and generate
Bogus traffic? So in other words, you're talking about social engineering.
Well, yeah. If it doesn't look like a good box, if it looks like if it doesn't look like a real life box, if you don't have traffic going, things like that, you're going to have problems. So, I think what we're going to do probably, one of the interesting things about the HoneyNet is that the only traffic that's going out is that's there is bad traffic, and so we don't have to filter stuff. But we're going to add traffic and then keep track of it. So that we'll do is we'll have our pseudo traffic, and we'll have the bad guy's traffic, and we'll just filter it out, and then we'll be able to see who's got what.
Another short point is that we do want to put some pseudo web applications. We want to put some web servers up there. We want to see some other stuff. A lot of things are happening at layer 7. A lot of actually interesting things are happening. So we'd like to model that.
And another thing we tried on this, you know, how do you make it real? We actually do real. For example, RFP, Rainforest Puppy, gets all sorts of NT attacks. For a while there, he had a sign-in guest log on his website. You go, click here, and you get to sign in his guest book. You're really signing into one of our honeypots. It virtually, when you clicked on that, you hopped to one of our honeypots. He got hacked. We got it. We caught everything. So you can actually include a production system within your HoneyNet. Question, go ahead. Yeah, we're going to be covering that in a couple slides. That's the entire trick to the HoneyNet. Because we allow the bad guys to do everything they want, we create a high-risk environment. We do a variety of steps. The question was, is how do you stop the bad guys once they hack your system to hack other people? We take a variety of steps. We're going to be covering in that. And what's more exciting is in the second section, we're developing new generation HoneyNets to even take this farther, which Dave Dietrich will be talking about. So that is one of the reasons why we don't want people to run out and say, oh, this HoneyNet concept is so cool. Let me just slap it up my internal network. Oh, boy. Do you want to tell you a little funny story?
A little funny story. You set it up and got hacked before you did.
All right, here's a funny little story.
My funny little story, we first set up our HoneyNet at the in a lab at the Naval Postgraduate School shortly after I saw Lance here at a SANS conference, and maybe 4 or 5 hours after we just hooked it up to the internet, it was hacked, and it started scanning 3 Class B networks. So part of the what Lance is going to start cover out later about containment is pretty important.
In other words, what Rob is saying is his HoneyNet got hacked, and the guy was scanning before he even finished setting up their HoneyNet. An interesting statistic, the fastest one of our honeypots has ever been hacked is 15 minutes. And this should scare the hell out of you. We do nothing to advertise. We'll be covering this later in entrapment. We don't go out there and taunt the guys on IRC. We just put the systems out there. Remember, this is my ISDN line in my home bedroom. This is not, you know, we're saying we're IBM or something like that. Okay, we'll keep going. Question. Okay, excellent question. No, that we'll save that for the second part. Question was, is what's average? Well, one, we're going to be releasing a new paper soon led by Jeff Stutzman and Max Kilgore, statistics weenies. It's called Know Your Enemy Statistics, and we're going to be releasing all the statistics we've discovered and future statistics, like, you know, 15 minutes, the fastest system hacked. It depends on the OS. The different people look for different OSs and stuff like that. The one that we found with the shortest lifespan would be a default installation of Red Hat 6.2. Yes. Yeah. For the expected life expectancy based on our research of a Red Hat 6.2 server is 72 hours. That you don't advertise it, no web server, nothing. You just drop it in there. The last time we attempted to confirm this, it lasted 8 hours. What operating systems last the longest? It really depends. We haven't done as much research on that. It's not, like I said, what we've done in the past is we just put boxes on the internet and we don't do anything to advertise them. We just do default installations. We don't give them value. So the Linux boxes are getting hacked the most, which means you got black hats who are looking for systems of no value. They just want a launching point.
One point on that, too. This is a home ISP-style network, so you're going to get attacks that are designed for home users.
Exactly. And this is not shameless shilling, but if anyone out there has got an odd box that they want to get rid of, we're looking for stuff, and we'll take it. We're not a nonprofit yet, but that's coming up. We'll talk about that. But if you have, like, what we're looking for, God, I feel like Sally Struthers. For just 10 cents a day. Less than the price of a cup of coffee. What we're looking for is HPUX, AIX, real-time OS. If everybody's got any QNX or Neutrino or RTOS, VTOS, yeah, anything, we'll take it. Anybody's got a YMP, we'll take that too.
I don't think there's enough room in Lance's
bedroom. Actually, the other reason I had to pull the plug on the HoneyNet is because literally the bedroom was overheating. During the summer, I have problems with keeping it cool. Yeah, we got a wire too and stuff like that. Questions? Were there any more questions as we continue on here? Oh, over here. Wait, no, we're just ignoring the right side. Go ahead.
You said it's critical that they don't know that it's a honeypot system. How do you ensure? I mean, people volunteer chunks of their domain space and so forth. How do you ensure that it looks like a legit system on a normal corporate?
Okay, the question was: is how do we make it look like a legit system on a normal corporate network? We haven't done that yet. To this point, it's only been sitting off my spare bedroom, so it's been home IP addresses. But now we're starting to deploy with the Navy, with universities, with corporations. Now that people actually realize we're serious about our research, we're getting community help. So that's our next step. That's the next session. Question?
So you basically set these boxes just out there in the open. You don't have any type of layers?
Okay, we'll be talking. You're getting more into technical details. A couple more slides. All right, we're going to drive some more slides here. Okay, possible uses. Intelligence gathering, that's mainly what we're all about. Testing an environment, you want to test an app, drop it in a honey net. Incident response, deception, and deterrence. As we'll be talking in the second session, intelligence gathering is our priority, primary goal. We'll get to your other questions, but we want to move on here in a little bit. All right, entrapment.
I tend to answer this question a lot. Entrapment, and I'm not a lawyer. Any lawyers out here want to agree or disagree? We're not law enforcement. We can't entrap people. These are systems that do not have public services available. Therefore, we don't have ECPA restrictions like an ISP would. We put these systems out there. Someone breaks into them. These are not systems that they're allowed to use. There is case law out there. If you look at the DOJ's guidelines on evidence collection, whatever it was called, that came out in 2000. It says that if somebody breaks into somebody's system and communication is captured on that system, they have no expectation of privacy because they don't own the system. So, no problem.
Yeah, he said expectation of privacy. That's what I said. On your personal box, there is no, again, not a lawyer, there is no expectation of privacy, though. And one of the arguments that people often make is called enticement to mischief, and it's completely... Yeah, that's completely facetious. That's like, you should not have been walking in that neighborhood, you wouldn't have been mugged. You should not have been wearing provocative clothing, you wouldn't have been harassed, etc. They're all facetious arguments, and Jennifer's probably here, and if someone wants to talk about this, she'll probably answer those questions.
Yeah, the analogy here is if you, in your front doorway, put a camera there watching people who knock on your door, or even if they break into your door, you know, you take pictures of them while they're in there. You know, clearly that's reasonable from my non-lawyer perspective.
Like I said, we do nothing active to gain information. The bad guys hack our systems. We passively gather everything. We do nothing to lure them. And like I said, we don't make the systems insecure. They're the same system many of you are running at home, same to many organizations. All we're doing is watching the traffic a little more closely.
The next question that people usually ask after that is, so you're watching these guys do these things. When do you cut it off? And we do cut it off as soon as we know that there's something going on that is starting to get out of our control.
And let's see here. Okay, that brings up a good point. There's, well, like you said, we've been telling everything we do, how do we do it? What about the risk? What about the maintenance? This is one of the reasons we're very nervous about people going, oh, what a great concept, let me go run home and build it myself, drop it in my corporate network. Honeynets can introduce risk to an environment. Other issues, they require constant maintenance, constant updating, things like that. They're cheap to build, but they take a lot of manpower. Thus, universities are great because lots of free grad students. For example, one of the things we're coming up with, and this is what Dave really found he's really good at, is a single compromise, a system gets compromised, at a minimum 30 to 40 hours of our time to figure out what happened. So it's very time intensive. They're not a drop-in solution. Okay, a little bit how they work, and we're going to get into technical stuff here. A highly controlled network, every packet entering or leaving our network is captured and analyzed. Any traffic is entering it is suspect by nature. It's kind of an isolated network set off. Anything, there's no production functionality in there that your company really has to use. So anything going in there is suspect by nature. Anything, for example, if any packet enters our HoneyNet, somebody is most likely probing us. Or attacking us. If any packet, if any connection initiates from their HoneyNet outbound, something's most likely been compromised. This helps eliminate both false positives and false negatives. Two critical elements to a HoneyNet: data control, data capture. Data control is this functionality where we limit what the bad guys can do. We have to ensure that they can come in, but they can't go out and hack other people. Data capture, research. If we don't capture what they did, we're wasting our time. And one, as you're going to see here, one of our primary tools for data capture is Monsieur Snort. Data control. What we've tended to do in the past, we allow anything into our HoneyNet. Dude, can you like put that on vibrate? I mean, we've all got our phones on vibrate. the end of the day, we have an auction. All right. Like I said, what we do with the HoneyNet, we allow anything inbound, but we limit what can go outbound. The idea is we have to let them come in, and we have to let them to go out. But the what happens is we have to control what they can do out. The first time we set up a HoneyNet, the bad guy came in, we allowed nothing outbound. Bad guy caught on, blew the hard drive within 15 minutes. So you have to have allow outbound. So what the problem is how much outbound do you allow? How much risk are you willing to take? The more outbound you allow, the more you can learn, but the more risk you have. So you have to mitigate this risk. How do we do it? Oh, here's an example of an email alert. When one of my when one of the honeypots gets hacked, we get an email alert. How do we know when a honeypot's been hacked? When in, one of the ways we know is if it attempts to initiate a connection outbound. If a system that nobody should be talking to is all of a sudden initiating outbound connections, something screwy is going on. That's one way of how we know HoneyNet's been hacked. Here's an email that would indicate that a system's been hacked. Yeah, in this email, you see under source, if you look in the middle, it says source. Date, time, source. The victim, say victim 7, that means it's honeypot number 7. And all of a sudden, he's FTPing out to a website. This is a very common way we know the bad guys hacked one of our systems. So this is our alerting mechanism. Data capture. As you're about to see, we capture data in a variety of layers also. We use firewall logs, router logs, IDS. IDS is, like I said, one of the most critical elements we have. System activity, keystroke logging, and one of the big ones also is forensic analysis. No single layer will provide all the information you need. Also, you have all those layers running, I guarantee you at least one of them is going to be broken every time a honeypot gets hacked. You have to have layers, redundancy, because something's always breaking. Hard drive space filling, processes mysteriously dying, all sorts of stuff. So you have to have this redundancy of layers because something's going to just barf. Here's an example of us capturing keystrokes. This is what you see is syslog entries to the far right are the actual keystrokes. Here you see an evil guy going ahead and doing all sorts of things. Notice the command to the bottom right, pico, FTP access. Many a kitty have never, VI just blows their mind. Capturing keystrokes is one of our best sources of information. And it, yeah, entertainment. What's very interesting is this goes into a flat file. I mean, you try to get alerted as soon as possible when a bad guy gets hacked. When your honeypots is hacked and you're alerted while you're awake, you can go ahead and do a tail minus F on this file. You're watching the keystrokes in real time.
K wrote that.
What's that?
Oh, I'm sorry, question. Okay, good question. When we publish this information, do we sanitize? It depends. When they do minor stuff, things like that, or the IPs of people have scanned us, no. When we start talking about credit card numbers or, you know, critical infrastructure systems, yes. Okay, the question is what do you do if the bad guy sees these logs? To date, to the best of our knowledge, nobody has ever been able to figure out they were on a HoneyNet unless we let them know, or B, nobody's been able to use our systems to attack anybody else.
But we would love to have somebody go after the logging servers and such. That would be an indication of something that's a little bit more sophisticated.
We're going to show that in a minute how we do that.
Exactly correct.
Yeah.
And hopefully in the future we'll probably integrate one more phone and I'm going to snap. Snap! Oh, Andrew, get out! What we hope to do in the future is more sophisticated stuff like core SDIs, modular syslog, and secure syslog. Then it's fairly problematic. No one is going to be able to, quote, go after your log, end quote, but they could conceivably do something to the logs. But at least from that point backward, you have good data. And that would be clearly indicative of a serious problem. We'd just disconnect those people. We have no problem with disconnecting. We're not really a production system.
Okay, I'm going to take a question here in a minute. But we're going to be holding off on this slide right here for a while because this slide details. It looks boring. It looks simple. But it covers the heart of a HoneyNet, how we capture data, how we control data, things like that. There was a question. Question, go ahead.
When do you let hackers know that you've
The question is, what do the bad guys do when they find out? Strangely enough, we've never been attacked, to the best of my knowledge. We've never been retaliated against. Probably one of the most unique incidents when the bad guys found out is Samuel is going to be covering here probably one of our best intelligence gathering situations.
Oh, sorry. What happened is we track guys for 3 weeks, we analyze the information, and then we release the paper. In this case, the paper was Know Your Enemy Motives. We were still tracking the bad guys when they when we released the paper. We were going to see how long it took them to figure it out. Yeah, it was 4 hours. So this really shows you how fast the Black Hat community can. In fact, didn't you capture some IRC? Yeah, but K2, didn't you capture?
Yeah, I don't know if you want
to talk about this.
Yeah, there were just some guys.
It was just kind of funny, you know. I was just chilling on IRC and everything, and then some guys start talking about how their buddies are in this paper, and it was, I don't know, just kind of funny. It happened within just a couple hours after the paper was released.
Anyways, we know that they found out it was them because the reason we know it's 4 hours is because mysteriously their connection and all their communications with the system ceased within 4 hours. Wham, they just terminated everything. And they left us a nice friendly little message, but I can't say that here because we're being taped. Between D, no, E and G. Yeah. There was a question.
Sure, that's actually Jeff. So he's a profiler. He's the profiler, and I'm more the social guy. So I'll let him answer that.
Oh boy. When you're going through the IRC logs, there's a lot of things that'll actually tip you off to for example, how old somebody is. When he says, "Oh, my mom's coming, got to go back to bed." So that was an easy one. There was another segment where one of the actors, we'll call him, had tried to impress a girl, and he couldn't do it, and he claimed to be a Fed, and then he had to go back and prove to her that he wasn't a Fed. So he basically knew this guy was a kid, but he turned out to be what, 300 pounds or something. So we figured he was a 17-year-old 300-pound kid touching his keyboard with one hand, and we'll leave it at that because we're being taped.
And what we were going to do when we get in the second session after this is for the more humans, like I said, a lot of people have been able to find the tools and the tactics of the bad guys, but rarely do we get the motives. And that's why we have a psychologist, a profile and stuff. We're going to show you, we have some resources in the second session where we detail these guys profiling and do psychological analysis on the people. That's why we want them hanging around on our system for weeks on end. You can learn all sorts of good dirt. All right, I'm going to jump in here. Let me go ahead and start a little bit with the HoneyNet breakdown. And Dave, do you want to talk about it? I'll start, and then guys can jump in. What you see on the screen is the HoneyNet. It's what we call our first generation HoneyNet. It's out of date now. We're going to be talking in the second session about second generation HoneyNets. This is the first generation HoneyNet. What I'm going to do is we seem to have more people on the over here. I'll point out things, but what you see is a firewall segmenting three networks.
Are we in trouble?
This is a firewall. It says firewall. It is segmenting our HoneyNet into three networks. You have the internet on top, you have what's called the HoneyNet off to the side, and then you have the network here. The idea is you let the bad guys come in, hack the HoneyNet, and then you control what they do out. The firewall is one of the primary means of doing it. The firewall rule base allows anything in, but eliminates initiating connections outbound. What we have done is we say any system in the HoneyNet can initiate only 5 to 10 connections out to the internet. Sometimes we change it. We do that with dynamic rules on the firewall. This is actually a rather brute force method, but it worked. David Dietrich in the second session is going to go into how we're developing more elegant solutions to this. But the firewall will only allow any single honeypot to initiate 5 to 10 connections. After the 5 to 10, it'll automatically cut them out. So basically what happens, the bad guys get on board, if they try to scan, probe, destroy, denial of service, anybody else on the internet, the firewall will block it. But the 5 to 10, if maybe they just FTP, initiate IRC out, and stuff like that. So we give them enough room to start some initiating connections out to the internet, but we control how many up to a limit, a certain number. Question?
What are you running your firewall?
Okay, in the past, for the firewall, since I was running my homeroom, was Checkpoint Firewall 1. Somebody going, what is a guy doing in a spare bedroom with a $30,000 firewall? I do a lot of work with Checkpoint. I do a lot of beta testing and stuff like that, so I was always doing eval versions. Everything we're doing now, this point on, is totally open source. The script that this firewall, the script that works with this firewall, will work with IP tables, IP filter, you have to modify it. But, I mean, we've got Jay Beal here helping us with IP filter, IP tables, and other firewalls. So we're going to all the firewalls we're going to be using in the future will be open source. Question? I see where you're going. How are you going to go after the more sophisticated guys? We'll go over that in the next session, where we're going. Go ahead. Question. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, thanks.
All right, there was a question. No, it's a simple script. If you're interested later on in the details of the script, how do we do this? We released one of our Know Your Enemy series papers. It's called Know Your Enemy HoneyNet. We detail everything. How we did it, we release all source code, we hide nothing. We figure if we're doing something stupid, hopefully one of you guys will let us know. The idea being here is, so the HoneyNet's here, admin network here, firewall. Notice we have a separate box for IDS. In the past, we ran the IDS on the firewall. We trust Marty's code. The idea being is this. Sparkbox, Linuxbox, NTbox, syslog server, firewall. Anything going through the network, the firewall logs and the IDS logs. So we capture all the activity. What happens on all the systems is they record all their activity to the remote syslog server. So you hack the Linuxbox or NTbox, all the keystrokes, all the activity, all that stuff's getting piped over the network to the syslog server. No data is stored on the NTbox or on the honeypots. Bad guys hack it, they find that data, then either they know they're on a honeypot or they blow that data away. Either way, we lose. Do you guys want to jump in? I'm here for it. Oh. Now, the syslog server. The syslog server is actually also a honeypot. The idea is this. The bad guys hack one of these easier systems, default in Linux, default NT, default Solaris. But they hack those systems. If they're pretty good, maybe they'll realize they're on a syslog. There's a syslog server. So many times the bad guys will go after a syslog server. Syslog servers are more heavily armored, so hopefully you'll start seeing more sophisticated tools. Some of you going, though, you guys are idiots. Why are you keeping your syslog server on the HoneyNet? Shouldn't you keep it on a protected network? What happens if your syslog server gets attacked and they successfully hack it? We say beautiful. We want them to hack our syslog server. We want them to blow everything away. Because in this diagram, there's actually a second syslog server. Which one is it? The IDS. He is a passive syslog server. Don't forget, syslog, packets dumped to the network. Have your IDS passively grab it. Seriously, I mean, that's something you can try in your own network. Have Marty Snort be your syslog server. Have all your systems sending packets to something that doesn't exist, and your sniffers grabbing things passively. Kind of hard to attack something with no IP address.
It's a paper I put together on nswc.navy.mil, like whack tilde shadow, something nutty. We'll put it on the HoneyNet page if you want to see a paper on just how to do exactly what Lance said.
Question?
You've got a lot of well-respected programs up there. Have any of them benefited from the research, or have you just done papers? Or has Bastille been strengthened, or has something else come as a benefit?
Endless hours.
I know, good question. Marty's probably been with us the longest.
Go ahead.
I've written some functionality specifically into Snort for the honeypot systems, specifically the session keyword for logging session data. There's a few other things. Some of the passive fingerprinting rules that we developed were just of interest to see, you know, who's poking at us and things like that. So there's been a reasonable amount of functionality. Every once in a while, Lance will send me a message that says, gee, it sure would be nice if we could do this. And, you know, a couple hours later, I'll say, try it now.
I've gotten lots of free drinks for the Forensic Challenge work.
Well, now that people are developing code, K2's developed code, we'll talk about your polymorphic kernel drivers later. But, yeah, I don't know if anybody else. So basically what you see here is the HoneyNet. All the alerts are sent to the log server in the lower right-hand corner. This is how we make things happen. Questions? Go ahead. Purpose of the router. Two purposes. Excellent question. The bad thing is the bad guys, there's no router, and the bad guys hack one of the honeypots, they'll see there's this firewall. What kind of firewall lets them do anything inbound but nothing outbound? So we put the router in between them and the firewall. So they just think there's a router there. They see a router. We're not going to try to put some software on the firewall to emulate routers and stuff like that. It doesn't work with the good guys. So we emulate nothing. The router also does basically egress filtering to make sure anti-denial service attacks can't go outbound and stuff like that. So the router is just a second layer to help hide the firewall. Dave Dietrich will talk later on in the second section, though, how we've changed that. Question? How are we going to ever move to bridging? Like I said, Dave Dietrich will be talking to the second session. So you just stole the thunder out of Dave, yes. Question? Have we ever seen somebody trying to fingerprint our firewall? To the best of our knowledge, no, but maybe that definitely could have happened. Question? There was back here. Oh, go ahead. Have we seen somebody go after the IDS or doing anti-IDS attacks? Not really. That's the problem, though, of these systems sitting off a home network. You're not getting the best and the brightest. You're just getting guys who want IP addresses. What we really want to do is go after the more sophisticated black hats, and that's how we're going to be going after the second session. Besides, Marty's code is so good that nobody could spoof it.
I want to add on the firewall question. If you are not blocking your firewall from generating ICMP error messages, I might be able to fingerprint the firewall. Because the firewall using its own stack and not the system he pretends to spoof the error message for. So do two rules basically with firewalls. Protect the firewall from any traffic to it, and do not allow the firewall to generate any ICMP error message.
Yeah, based on Ophir's research, we modified a rule base just because of that, because he didn't want the firewall sending out ICMP error messages. Were there more questions? We'll start here. Go ahead. How do we? Oh, the domain names. Sometimes we give them names. Sometimes we'll make up names. The question is, sometimes we'll register domain names. Like I said, in the past, we haven't done too much social engineering. In the future, we're going to start really registering some good domain names because maybe we want to be an e-commerce site, stuff like that. Once again, second session. There was another question. Go ahead.
Which country do you find most of the bad guys?
I got some stuff on that, but go ahead.
That's like a really tough question to answer because a lot of people are semi-sophisticated in proxy. But I could speak from my naval experience. It was always, quote, countries with interests contrary to our own, end quote. So use your imagination on that. There's some very fascinating stuff coming out of like the .ro domain, the .ru domain, the .cn domain, and Canada.
That's an excellent question. That's a question. Now, where do we see? I want to raise a point on that. That's one of the neat things about HoneyNets. Well, how do you know what nationality is when somebody scans you? For example, people complain about Korea all the time. I've even seen people say, oh, this guy from Korea scanned me. I'm very elite. I just scanned him and took him out. Aren't I cool? These are system administrators, white hats. That infuriates me. Example, we had a honeypot hacked. The guys came in from Korea, just messed up our system, wham. makes it look like it's coming from Korea. No. How do we know that they weren't Koreans? Because they fired up IRC and dropped into Romanian. They were talking Romanian. This is the kind of intel you can get from a honeypot that you're letting running. So we know these guys are Romanian. What they were doing is they're hopping. That system from Korea, if we had retaliated against them, that system from Korea, we did a lookup, was a system belonging to an elementary school. So all you elite admins that go out and retaliate, you just took out a bunch of third graders.
Yeah, another point on that is that, you know, even though you kind of have to discard the source IP address a lot of times when you're doing the analysis, is understand that, you know, even a sophisticated hacker is only going to have a certain pool of sites that they're going to jump through. So a lot of times when you're going back and looking at these things and trying to do correlations, their OPSEC stinks a lot of times. Maybe they've got five that they'd use all the time, and we'll see them coming from those five all the time. So it makes it easier to track them back the next time.
One more point, and I can't emphasize this enough.
Therein lies litigation. I can't emphasize that enough. I don't want to make light of it, because it is kind of, people chuckle, but you can't hack back. It's you're going to get all sorts of grief for that.
Did you guys contact the administrators of those boxes?
Oh, God. All right. Question, do you contact the administrators? We did once. We'll never do it again. We contacted 300 people in one incident. Out of those 300 emails we sent out, we got 5 replies back. Out of those 5 replies, 2 are going to send their lawyers against us. 2 actually thanked us. The 5th one was the guy that hacked the system. We don't do that anymore. What we do is we forward all information to both NIPSI and CERT. And that's their job. We let them do it. We just do research. Question. Hasn't happened in 2 years. The question was, is we post a lot of times the systems that hack us. We post the IPs. Do we get any litigation against us? Not to this point.
Yeah, we thought about this quite a lot with the forensic challenge, because we were releasing a drive that had stuff on it that we didn't necessarily know was there. So we made efforts, our best efforts at that point, early on in the investigation, to identify sites that we knew were either stepping stones or points of origin, and let them know, you need to go try and find these customers and take care of this, because this information is going to go public. So, you know, as long as you do that, as long as you make your best effort to notify people as early as possible and do the right thing, you know, you're fairly protected.
Okay, tell you what I'm going to do here is shift into high gear here, and we're going to skip some stuff, and let's give you an example.
Let's do the years. We're going to do the sample.
Social engineering, we'll talk about that later. 100-net summary, yeah, it's great stuff. The threat. We're releasing a paper on this, just some statistics. This isn't, you don't believe you guys have this page. Windows 98 honeypot, we were going to show that, but we're running out of time. Got hacked 5 times in 4 days. Anybody, like one of the things we wanted to demonstrate was, if you home users, the hackers aren't just going after the corporations. Home users, if you have a dedicated connection, you're getting probably hammered about 5 to 10 times a day. We did a Windows 98 honeypot. We enabled sharing on it. It was hacked in 24 hours. It was hacked another 4 times in 3 days. Just some other statistics. We're releasing a paper soon on this, so I don't want to go into this. Okay, we're now going to go into real-world examples. There's 2 in here. We're going to skip the Windows 98 system. Let's go into the Solaris. This is just an example of how you can collect the data, what it looks like, and stuff like that. And this is where we're going to be calling in the other members. We'll have Marty explain some of the decodes. Samuel's talking about some of the translations. Yo. How we're going to present the data. Look at the screen. That's a terminal. Basically, SSH into the system auto. Auto is one of my forensic systems. We have all this data on there. So when you see the system here, auto, that's not the hack system. That's just the system with the data on it. For example, we did an LS. This is the contents of a rootkit. So when you see the system, that's the system where just the data is retained on. All right, we're going to skip the Windows system. You can read that. That's also our Worms at War paper. You can find that online. Okay, compromised Solaris system. For those of you who have read the paper, Know Your Enemy Motives, this is one of the better examples of the intel HoneyNet can give you. Not only are you getting their tools, not only are you getting their tactics, but you're capturing their motives.
You didn't write this expert, did you? Tool talk, database. Who wrote that one? Who wrote that one?
I recall some.
No, I didn't.
All right, just making sure I'm one of our own. Okay, this is a year ago. We did a default installation of Solaris 2.6. So if anybody out there running Solaris 2.6, default installation, unpatched, you're vulnerable to this. Of course, this was a couple years ago, so if you're running unpatched Solaris 2.6, you've got greater problems. In this case, we're going to show you step-by-step how the bad guys came in, how they exploited the box, and what they did once they exploited the box. What's very interesting is they used us as an IRC bot relay. So all their conversations and all their friends' conversations was relayed through our system. We did not go out and capture their conversations. We sat back and just monitored our own traffic and got their conversations. Okay, it was the box was exploited by a remote RPC service exploit, in this case the ToolTalk database service. Here we see...
Did you want to go up the screen and talk about your snort alerts and all that stuff, or you just want me to... You go ahead. The guy wrote it, so I'll let him talk about it.
Well, let's see. We got a syslog alert out of snort here. You see the IDS 241, that's the tag into the Arachnid's database to look up backing information. But you can see Snort's alerting us here to a buffer overflow, TTDB buffer overflow on Solaris, coming from 192.168.12 going to our internal machine on 32.775.
Well, so what you see here.
Oh, okay.
Oops. And let's go back up there real quick, the IP address in this case is not sanitized, so that's a real IP address that hacked us. Notice the source port. What's the source port tell us? He's got root on the system, because it's below 1024. So basically we got a Solaris exploit. We've just been notified in real time to this mighty fine IDS system that our system's been hacked. Real time notification is important. Okay, then what this exploit does is the purpose is to create a root shell on our system. He wants access. So what we see here is the snort decode. For those of you who have never decoded snort, or this is a snort attacks, the stuff on the left, hexadecimal, stuff on the right, the ASCII conversion of that. Do you want to talk about this at all? Or?
You can see... For crying out loud, stop putting your root shells on 1524. You've got a standard Solaris buffer overflow here. You can see, is this compressed or something?
I don't know.
Did you snip it? It looks like it was snipped down.
It's been compressed a little bit.
Yeah, you can see the no-op sled here, the 81C4011s. Those are your no-ops on Solaris. You can see a standard RPC query at the top. Then you get into your no-op sled and your shell code, and then you hit your, they're popping off bin K shell here, and then putting a new entry onto the classic port 1524 into etsyinetd.conf. So they're setting themselves up a backdoor into the system at this point. The rest of the snort information, you can see the source and destination IPs still coming from port 878. Push ACK, you can see that this session has been established and the sequence numbers and stuff like that. It's pretty pretty standard buffer overflow, really. It's definitely Solaris. You can see that Solaris no op sled pretty clearly in the dump.
So what the guy's done here is he's created a new INETD configuration file. He's restarted it.
So now he's got, based on this new INETD file, he's got a port listening as root on 1524, because INET he set it up as root. He creates two accounts, UID 500 and UID 0. Anybody can explain why a black hat would create two accounts? Why doesn't he just create one account as UID 0? Exactly. He can't go in as UID 0. He's got to go in as, by default, Solaris does not allow you to tell him that in as UID 0. This is very common if they come in this way. What you see here is keystrokes. This is Marty's session breakout functionality. What Snort will do is if it sees keystrokes, ASCII, it'll dump in a flat text file for easy to read. And what you see here is he's created two accounts. What's the password on the accounts? Yeah, there are none. That way he doesn't have to remember. Like I said, these are the real keystrokes, real bad guy. Oh, okay, once he creates these accounts, he takes control of the system. All right, what you see here are his keystrokes. You see him at the top. You can see the term set, Linux, so you know he's coming in from Linux. He's logging in as RE, then he has to use the root. R. Once again, remember, he's created these accounts. The first thing he does is he creates a directory. What's unique about this directory?
Go ahead. The Dave's thing is about 1,000. Go ahead, tell.
About what?
About this hidden thing.
Okay, so this is fairly common. Somebody creates a hidden directory in dev. In this case, dot, and dot are going to show up in an LS listing. Most people, they're just going to breeze right by that. Some sysadmins won't even know how to get past the fact that there's a space in there. It's true. They love it. If you can't do that, they know that they can stay on your box for a long time.
Yeah. By the way, Dave Dietrich's in charge of the largest honey net in the world. University of Washington. His university has given us great data. Okay, and at the bottom, you see one of the first things this guy does, git sun2.tar. This is their rootkit. It's very common. First thing, dude, create. So what he's doing? Boom, I've got access. Boom, I've got root. Boom, create a hidden directory. Change into that hidden directory. Well, I don't know if you want to call it hidden, but. And then they get their rootkit. By the way, if you want, you can download this rootkit from the website. All right, once the rootkit is downloaded, he installs it. You can see it's fully automated. This is what you can see in the rootkit. You see replacements for things like netstat, ps, ls, bind, things like that, you know, replacing the binaries. So this is not a kernel-level rootkit. Remember, this is about a year ago. We've just now started seeing the kernel-level rootkits in the past 6 months with our honeypots. Notice Pico. Like I said, once again, VI blows their mind. Solaris does not come about Pico, so they had to download it for their own personal use.
This is also a nice example of the quality of code in rootkits. When I saw this, and Lance asked me to look at it, and I saw that program called Fix, and I went in, it's a binary, but I looked at it, and it's a program I wrote in 91. It was my first hacking program for CentOS 4, and it doesn't work at all for Solaris. And I don't know, it's still in the kits out there, and it's in all kits.
Think about the mindset of the person who had to port Pico to Solaris, by the way.
We move on. All right, everything's automated. Why is it automated? A, it's faster. B, they don't have to worry about how to install it. So how do you install this rootkit? You type setup. Exactly what happens here. You see at the top, they untars it. And then he goes ahead at the bottom, he types setup.sh. So we go ahead, and that launches it. Let's go ahead. What's it do? Actually, this is not a bad rootkit in the log cleaning. It's not sophisticated, but I don't know if Dave wants to talk about it all. But you see it going into the actual binary log files and wtemp, utemp, stuff like that, and it's removing them, stuff like that, taking out the entries. So he's trying to hide the fact that they were ever on the system. Is this common? Do you normally, Dave, see him blow the logs away or try to clean the logs?
One of two things is done usually on a system that gets rooted with these kits. Either they run a program that selectively takes out entries, hiding where they're coming from, and most of the time the information about what they're hiding is on the system, so you can figure that out even though they've taken it out. And the other option is they'll just go in and blow away all the log files, just RM, so you can recover those with tools like Corner's Toolkit. If you get it in time, which is more common. I see a little of each. I mean, it depends on the mentality of the person that's coming in, their skill level, or what kit they're using.
All right, the script continues. What's the script do now? It fixes the holes. He's patching your system. He's killing the processes that got in. Why is he doing that? Because he knows how aggressive his buddies are. He doesn't want his buddies getting his real estate. A lot of time, hacking's all about real estate. The more boxes you own, the more real estate you have. You see, is this common too? You see this a lot? Yeah, I've personally seen guys RPM download the latest RPMs to patch the system, things like that.
Look at the forensic challenge reports. The guy had I don't know how many RPM files. Some of them were for the wrong architecture, so they backed certain things out and they broke.
But I mean, they were like trying to clean up everything on that Linux system.
Did you want to say something?
These little things that go out and secure the system after they gain access, you're seeing a lot of that functionality added to worms, because of course you take over, you don't want another worm to blow you away once you're on there. And I tell you, I think some of these worms, like the lion worm that fixed the RPC stat debug and such, fixed more problems than actual system administrators, humans out there. These things just rampantly run across the net and break into the systems and then try to secure them. So.
What you didn't see, because the script didn't have it in output, like I said, what you were looking at there were the actual keystrokes. Once again, what you're seeing here is Marty's session breakout functionality. Things you didn't see the script do, replacing login, PS, LS, netstat, your standard binary replacement rootkit. Okay, and the fun part, what they decided to do is decided to set up IRC bots on our system. For those of you who aren't too familiar with IRC, K2.
An IRC bot is a client piece of software that sits on IRC and basically facilitates any kind of actions that the bot master would like to have done on IRC. You know, war channels, flood people, and, you know, I don't know, spam IRC and stuff like that.
The nice thing about IRC, when they ran the IRC bot, is it captured all their conversations and anybody else who joined that IRC channel. Or any time these bad guys would join another channel, we now have all those conversations which are transferred through our system. We capture their conversations. Oh, yeah, and we discovered quite a few interesting things. First of all, here's our keystrokes starting up the bot. Nothing too exciting. Let's go ahead and blow through those. There's the configurations. But what was unique is here we say 2 weeks. We actually captured 3 weeks of their information. I'm going to let Samuel talk about it a little bit. Reason being is this group was from Pakistan. They had decided to target India. Samuel happens to be Indian. so he also speaks both Hindi and Urdu. So he was able, a lot of times, the hackers dropped into Urdu. So Samuel was our translator. But a little interesting story is we tracked these guys for 3 weeks. We saw them doing all sorts of evil things. We eventually had to get the FBI involved because we saw so much evil stuff happening. Normally, we don't involve the FBI. Bad guys hack our systems. We don't care. Nobody else cares. And why get the FBI involved? However, they were hacking hundreds of systems. Samuel started going into some more of the evil things they were doing. So we handed it over to the FBI. Interesting side story, when we handed it over to the FBI, they're like, oh, this is interesting, you know, nice kind of stuff. But, you know, they're attacking India. We really don't care, but we'll take it anyways. A couple months later, this very same group hacked into the Navy, NASA, National Observatory, all sorts of government infrastructure. Yeah. Fermilab?
FBI came back really interested.
Really interested.
No, that's right. That was him. Right. But he was working government. He's the one that did the analysis.
So, yeah, actually, they did NOAA and Fermilab. And what's really cool about this group of highly skilled political idealists, they were one router hop away from the world's third or fourth largest concentration of supercomputers in the world. This is a fact. And all they did was deface the web page. Right on.
So what we're going to do is we'll show you some of the IRC conversations, and I'll let Samuel go ahead and talk about a little bit in background about the bad guys. And then what's really interesting is Max Kilger, a psychologist, was able to do a psychological profile on these guys. And then what Jeff did over there is he profiled them. In other words, if you wanted to figure out who these guys were and wanted to go after them, it's amazing. You go through, and he was able to pull just bits of information, and then he narrowed it down to 300-pound, 17-year-old Pakistani living in Kashmir. I think you even had his phone number.
Yeah. We're going through the IRC logs, and this is Samuel, by the way, but going through the IRC logs, and we kept seeing YAR, Y-A-R, YAR, 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 YAR. And then the best quote in the entire IRC was a translation from Samuel that says, YAR equals dude.
Sorry. Actually, I've just been told we have 4 minutes left. So what we're going to do is this. We'll go ahead and take a break. Come back when you're supposed to come back. We'll finish up on the IRC stuff, let these go as analysis, and then we're going to go into what we got planned in the future.